A Texas abortion decision heard round the nation. New school COVID-19 quarantine guidance, plus Afghan refugees in Indiana, and more on Indiana Week in Review, the week ending September 3rd, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, some Indiana anti-abortion activists are sounding a note of cautious optimism about the future of restricting abortion in the Hoosier State. That's after the U.S. Supreme Court chose not to block a Texas law that effectively bans abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. The Supreme Court's move in the Texas case isn't definitive. The majority cited procedural issues as a reason not to block the law. But between that decision and an upcoming hearing over a Mississippi law that bans abortions after 15 weeks, many anti-abortion advocates believe the court will overturn its long-standing precedent, Roe v. Wade. American Family Association of Indiana Executive Director Micah Clark isn't one of those who believes Roe will be overturned.
The Supreme Court is much more moderate in my view. I mean, they'll go to the left on some things, to the right on some others. They don't seem to be a court that really wants to make major, huge decisions.
Still, anti-abortion advocates are already pushing for Indiana to pass a Texas-style law. And Clark says while he'd like that, he doesn't think Indiana will go that far yet.
Historically, we don't push the envelope that much. So I don't see Indiana doing anything until they get a green flag from the Supreme Court.
Indiana lawmakers' first opportunity to act will technically come later this month when they're in session for redistricting. Is the General Assembly about to push a lot further, a lot faster, on anti-abortion measures? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Arielle Brandy. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, Senate Republican Liz Brown, who is certainly no backbencher, has already said that she will author a Texas-style law in the upcoming session in January, not the redistricting session that's coming here in a couple weeks. But what should Hoosiers be looking at for out of the legislature?
Well, if Speaker Todd Houston's comments are any indication, maybe not all that much. If he did say that they were watching this closely, certainly a pro-life leader. I disagree a little bit with Micah that Indiana hasn't pushed the envelope on pro-life legislation. We're, you know, by any metric, one of the most pro-life states in the country. And we push the envelope so much the U.S. Supreme Court pushes it back sometimes. And so Indiana has led on a lot of the, you know, these types of initiatives. This one is, I think, even pro-life activists, while they're encouraged by this, this scheme that Texas has is very different than just a ban on abortion. It creates a civil action for anyone to bring a lawsuit to anyone that aids or abets an abortion, which is, if you read the Wall Street Journal this morning, conservatives are not huge fans of that because that scheme can be used in New York State to, you know, allow citizens to bring a civil action against someone who owns a gun. You know, and so you got to be careful about how you're setting this up. And then the prize is $10,000 for the person that brought it if they're found liable in that scenario. So it's a strange scheme. Even Texas went to the Supreme Court and argued that they weren't enforcing it yet. Nothing was happening, which is why the Supreme Court didn't take it. So this isn't a real clean shot victory for the pro-life community, which I think may be one of the reasons people like Micah Clark and others are tempering the expectation of the legislature this session.
Arielle Brandy, if you're a Hoosier who cares about their reproductive rights, how are you feeling right now?
Well, as a woman, as a mother, and as someone who, you know, believes in pro-choice and women being able to have a say in what they choose to do with their bodies, it's very disheartening to see what's happening in Texas. And this has a say for a lot of what could happen in Indiana. I do not put it past Republicans to try to pass something like this here in our state. But I also want to say that in the state of Indiana, abortion is a right, it's legal, and it's still safe here. And I'm still going to be an advocate for that. And I'm still going to be making sure that we're doing everything we can to make sure that Hoosiers still have that option, specifically women.
Nikki Kelly, we probably won't get any sort of definitive answer on what the Supreme Court will and will not allow in terms of abortion rights until next May or June. They're hearing the Mississippi case in October, but those opinions don't usually come out until the following summer. Do you anticipate, I mean, Liz Brown said she'd file the bill, but filing and passing are two different things. Do you think the legislature tries to see what they can do before the Supreme Court officially weighs in?
I personally would be shocked if they don't do it. And, you know, both the House and Senate supermajorities have a lot of very conservative members. You know, they could do something similar to how sports gaming was handled, where they pre-wrote the law and said, basically, wasn't there, I think there was a trigger in there saying, like, if this is upheld, this goes into effect. I think there should be some concern.
But that is a mechanism that was used for sports betting. It was just in other states.
Yeah, but there is a concern on that mechanism, and Mike definitely brought it up. And even Jim Bopp, who is well-known, you know, pro-life attorney, works for the National Right to Life, says that he doesn't think Indiana will go this route.
John Schwanes, conservatives are closer than ever to getting what they've been fighting for a long time, which is banning abortion outright. Are they going to be happy with that result in the long term?
I don't think they'll be happy with what's going to happen in Texas, because for the reasons that have been articulated here. This is that was Mike's word, and I think it's a good one. The scheme or arrangement that is put in place here specifically to thwart challenges and impede challenges to the law's constitutionality really has wide-ranging implications on issues other than abortion, as Mike suggested, and as the Wall Street Journal and many other media outlets have noted. This could be used by states that don't look fondly at gun ownership or unlicensed gun ownership, and it creates sort of our culture, our society is already strained. We're not very happy with one another, it seems, unfortunately. And it seems that if all of a sudden people are being given a $10,000 bounty anywhere in the country for reporting on supposed misdeeds, or even the possibility, apparently, the notion that somebody has the intention of getting an abortion or of aiding and abetting in someone else's abortion is enough, apparently, to trigger this process. I think that would strain the society even more than it already is in terms of something akin to what we would have seen behind the Iron Curtain, the Stasi, if you will, as some have suggested, where neighbors are looking out of their windows or peering into your windows, perhaps more appropriately, to find out what they can deduce that might lead to their $10,000 payment. It's an ugly situation. It doesn't matter if you're pro-life, pro-choice. This mechanism, this scheme is crazy.
I'm shocked to hear that what amounts to legalized vigilante justice might be a negative.
It came out of Texas.
Of Texas.
It's not just going to be, you know, neighbors looking at neighbors. I mean, you're going to hire, if that's so much money, you're going to have like industries built around this to like go systematically find these people.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, we asked you this a few weeks ago, and I'm curious to see if the results have changed. So, will the U.S. Supreme Court overturn legalized abortion? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question was, should companies charge employees who won't get vaccinated for COVID-19 more for their health insurance coverage? 81% of you say yes, 19% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. The Indiana Department of Health is loosening its school COVID-19 quarantine policy, but only for schools that are masking up. The new school guidance says close contacts do not have to quarantine at all as long as they don't have symptoms and everyone in the classroom is wearing a mask throughout the school day. That new guidance only applies to the classroom, not to close contacts in non-classroom or extracurricular settings. Otherwise, outside the classroom or in those where masks aren't being worn, the previous guidance still applies, as much as 14 days quarantine or as little as 7 days with a negative test. Still, Governor Eric Holcomb will not and likely will never reimpose a statewide mask mandate in schools. That's a decision he says he's leaving to local officials.
Fully support it, understand it. It's regrettable that so many of our kids are out of the classroom on any given one day.
The number of Hoosiers under age 18 who tested positive for COVID-19 increased more than 600% from July to August. Arielle Brandy, as a parent, are you comfortable with this new guidance?
Absolutely not. I think we really need to start thinking about how we shouldn't be placing these kind of decisions on our superintendents and teachers, and really start thinking about how we can mandate this across the state. I'm blessed that we're in a school corporation where masks are required, and it is definitely helping, but there are still kids that are getting sick and teachers are still getting sick, and we're seeing more and more of these stories across the state of Indiana. And it's unfortunate that we've also lost some teachers this school year already because of the fact that these school corporations are deciding not to mask up. So as a parent, I definitely think that Governor Holcomb does need to address this, and I would prefer that we not give it to the superintendents and our teachers to make that decision.
Mike O'Brien, also as a parent, do you like the idea? I mean, obviously the idea here is we're trying to make it so that kids aren't missing in-person classes, and that's an important goal. But do you like the fact that they're not going to be requiring any quarantine at all as long as masks are being worn by everybody?
Yes, I do. My kids, the two that are old enough, are vaccinated. They're wearing masks in school. My son was in high school for a minute before he got contact trace and had to go home until his second shot of his vaccine took effect, which was the policy to let him return. At some point, these kids have got to be in person and in school. I don't understand even why the extracurriculars are exempted from this. If you're sitting in a classroom for 7 or 8 hours and then your extracurricular, you're outside at football practice for an hour, why is that handled differently? I don't understand that. And how do they know? How do I know where I actually contracted it? It could have been in the classroom, or it could have been at dinner the night before. I agree that it's inconsistent and irrational, but the limits on the guidance need to be clearer too. And we don't see massive amounts of kids getting really ill. We never have. They can be vaccinated. We're getting closer and closer to under 12 being able to be vaccinated, and people need to either get on that program or their kids are just going to be at risk.
John Schwanes, this would seem to be another carrot from the administration who refuses to impose a statewide mask mandate in schools. Another carrot towards, hey, you should probably require masks because look at how much your kids won't have to be out of school. Do you think it'll work?
Well, if the numbers continue in the direction that we've seen in recent weeks and days, I think more and more districts and more superintendents will feel compelled to do something. Action will be required. You know, it's a shame that this whole issue became so politicized. I can't think of anything else that went off the rails in a fashion that this did, this epidemic, this pandemic, and the response to it. It's unlike anything I've seen, and why it had to be politicized, I know there's no point arguing about it now, why it happened because it did. But it's a shame. Decisions clearly are not being made based on the what's in the best interest of the health of students, their parents, or faculty members, or citizens at large. This is all having to do with how can we walk that fine line to not have rebellion on the part of some factions that want to go to fisticuffs, apparently, over this issue. It's beyond me, but I guess this is what we're stuck with.
Nikki Kelly, thinking through this new guidance for quarantine, does it create a situation, because as my wife and I talked about it, she raised this question. Does it create a situation where if everybody's wearing a mask and close contacts aren't symptomatic, but if little Johnny is out because, he tested positive for quarantine and little Janie is a close contact, are schools even going to be notifying those parents anymore that their children are close contacts but don't have to quarantine? Or are we telling them but they don't have to quarantine? Like, how is that going to work?
Yeah, I mean, according to the guidance that DOH put out, yes, the schools still have to quarantine, I mean, still have to contact trace. And then, you know, they will still tell the parents, but they won't have to quarantine as long as they're a mask mandate school. So that's intriguing. And one other interesting point about this is, I think it's a calculated risk. I think the governor has put this line in the sand. He is not going to mandate it. So now the risk, he's comfortable with this risk of the chance of a kid will get it while wearing a mask, and then B, also that they will transmit it to someone else also wearing a mask. So they have looked at a study in North Carolina and feel very comfortable with this option.
All right. Well, Indiana is preparing to receive 5,000 Afghan evacuees at Camp Atterbury in the coming weeks, with the first 1,000 having just arrived. Indiana National Guard head General Dale Lyles says the state is bringing resources and personnel from outside Indiana to meet the needs of evacuees. General Lyles stresses that Atterbury won't need to deplete any resources from the state, particularly when it comes to COVID-19.
We understand that emergency room wait times are higher than normal. We do not want to pressure local hospitals.
After an initial 14-day medical screening, evacuees will eventually be able to leave Atterbury temporarily and permanently. But Lyles says that's only after a four-fold vetting process. First, to get out of Afghanistan, then in holding areas in Europe or the Middle East, then once they arrive in the United States, and then again at Camp Atterbury itself. Governor Eric Holcomb says once they're cleared to permanently resettle in the U.S., he hopes refugees choose Indiana.
These are the same folks who, for decades, have assisted and aided us.
Holcomb says the state will be transparent with local communities and law enforcement about the vetting process and when evacuees will be able to leave Camp Atterbury. Nikki Kelly, Governor Holcomb talked about the importance of transparency throughout this process. How key, then, was this first press conference?
Oh, I think it definitely set the tone. You know, I've covered a lot of press conferences in life, and I can be pretty cynical about it, but they, you know, put so much information out there. They answered so many questions. I really think it is going to do, you know, a really good job of tamping down any fears or just out hatred, which sadly I have seen on some stories about it. So I think with the governor setting the tone of, you know, yes, we're welcoming these people, and but, you know, not without basically vetting and making sure everyone's safe and secure.
Yeah, to that point, Governor Holcomb and General Lyles talked a lot about the vetting process and how that's going to work and talking with law enforcement to make sure that there's no real danger to Hoosiers from once the evacuees who are here are then vetted and allowed to leave first temporarily and then eventually permanently. But John Schwanis, the reality, of course, here as well as any other state in the country is it may be a minority. Hopefully it's a minority. It may be a vocal minority. But there are folks, quite frankly, who are very racist and who are already sounding off about the fact that we are locating these folks here. And so there was a question raised at the press conference that I don't think was fully answered, but I'm curious your thoughts on how are we ensuring that these refugees are safe from some Hoosiers?
That's a great question, because you're right. If you'll recall, it wasn't too many years ago that there were high-profile officials in Indiana that sought to keep some would-be immigrants out of the state, even though it was thumbing the state's nose at federal law and federal guidelines on these practices. So it's not just small pockets of racism. Certainly that's the biggest problem. But there is a widespread concern or doubt, unfortunately, anytime you have immigrant groups coming into our state. I guess what I would suggest is that there are those haters and perhaps those who would do harm. Given the vetting process that these individuals have gone through, I think it's safe to say they will have been more thoroughly screened and been given a thumbs up to a degree that far surpasses the ancestors of the haters when they immigrated to this country. And I would hope that they would keep that in mind and probably won't necessarily do so. But let's hope that Hoosier hospitality reigns.
Yeah, to that point, Monk O'Brien, the situation that John just referenced with then Governor Mike Pence and Syrian refugees is not apples to apples, certainly, to this situation. But certainly the tone from Governor Holcomb was, you know, I am confident in the vetting process here and I want to throw my arms open to these folks and hope they stay here. How important is that in terms of filtering out to the rest of Indiana?
Very important. These weren't quiet allies of the United States for the last 20 years. These are people that were standing next to our, you know, our soldiers as translators or others who were helping. And they and their families were targeted to be killed by the Taliban. I mean, that's what's happening, right? And if I promise you that some of these people that are mouthing off that way were mouthing off 2 weeks ago about Joe Biden, how he handled this poorly. So how we abandoned people. We probably abandoned a lot more people than we saved. But the people that we did, we have to do right by, because they've done more than I didn't serve. A lot of these people have done more than I ever have to keep this country safe. And we ought to respect that and celebrate their safety.
All right, I want to move on here. A former employee of the state treasurer's office claims Treasurer Kelly Mitchell illegally awarded millions of dollars in contracts to private companies. James Holden filed the whistleblower complaint in Marion County Court. Holden previously worked for the treasurer's office and filed a wrongful termination suit against Mitchell, which he says in the court filing was settled 4 years ago. Holden's complaint alleges that Mitchell hired multiple outside lobbying and financial firms during her 2 terms, but never got those contracts approved by the Indiana Attorney General, the State Budget Agency, and the Indiana Department of Administration, as required by state law. And Holden's filing says many of the companies that received those contracts, including some of the nation's largest banks and one of the state's top lobbying firms, Ice Miller, are political allies and donors of Mitchell's. I should note here that Ice Miller is, of course, a sponsor of this program, though they do not have any say over the content or the discussion therein. So, John Schwanis, quite frankly, how big a deal is this?
I hope we can all agree it's a big deal if the facts that are put forth or the allegations put forth in the lawsuit are proved to be valid. It's a problem. State law is there for a reason. Procedures about awarding contracts are there for a reason. And we have a society here and in other states across the country where people already assume that, oh, it's just politics. People, you know, wealthy people get into politics and then they help their wealthy friends and it's a bad process. It doesn't matter. The cynicism just continues to flourish. Well, guess what? This is the kind of thing that would cause that cynicism to flourish because it validates it to a large extent. So let's hope we can all agree, if it's true, that it is a big deal and something that needs to be rectified.
In terms of how the public views this, Nikki Kelly, is that wrongful termination suit that preceded this the biggest complicating factor here?
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to assess, you know, whether this is sort of just a sour grapes response to the fact that he didn't get to keep his own questionable contract with the state, to be fair, and, you know, was terminated, or are these legitimate concerns? I mean, there are certainly exceptions to the bidding process, but as far as having contracts that aren't approved by those specific agencies, I mean, I'm really looking forward to seeing the office's response to this lawsuit. I understand that after talking to them today, they still haven't even been served it because it's under this sort of weird sealed situation with this specific law on whistleblowers.
Arielle Brandy is the next sort of stage at this point for Hoosiers, just waiting to see how this lawsuit plays out?
Yeah, I think Nikki hits it on the head. If they haven't even been served with exactly what this lawsuit entails, then yes. But I definitely think that the public should be keeping an eye on this because, like John said, this is a big deal. And I think that if we're looking forward at how we're doing contracts, this might shape how Indiana looks at it in the future. So I definitely say public should be keeping an eye. And I'm curious to see how this ends up going.
Yeah, Mike O'Brien, sort of the same question is, how should Hoosiers be viewing this situation?
Well, one is a personal vendetta from Jim Holden. I don't think Kelly Mitchell would disagree that the right procurement process needs to always take place when you're procuring whatever services, whether you're building a road with a private contractor, you're hiring an attorney or a financial advisor. So, I mean, there's a process for all these things to be followed. There is this gray world of political contributions, and both parties have to kind of deal with that and mind, you know, make sure they're doing things, you know, appropriately and not, you know, and transparently is the most important thing. And I'm sure Kelly will comply with all that and has.
All right. Well, finally, in what's clearly the biggest news of recent weeks, the Holcombs announced recently they have a new kitten. The cat Topper has been with Indiana's first family for several weeks now. Topper is so named because of its apparent penchant for climbing to the tops of trees. Mike O'Brien, a fine name, but what would be a more Indiana-appropriate name for the Hoosier State's first kitten?
Probably the wrong guy to ask. I've got two cats who I didn't name, and one is named Sir Beauregard G. Kitty Britches, and the other one's name is His Royal Highness Harry Winston Berkshire. So I'm probably the wrong guy to ask about this. So I'll just take it to Nikki.
Oh, that's Nikki, real quick.
I have a good one. Maize.
Maize.
Like corn.
Yeah, I got you. I like that one. No, that's a good one.
The governor's affinity for cowboy boots. How about Puss and Boots together?
Oh, that's not bad. All right. Well, we have to wrap up. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Arielle Brandy, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please get vaccinated if you can, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.